CFD community, science and tech friends. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Mesh Up. If you're joining us for the first time, I am your host, Tiffany Cook. And today's topic involves some discussion on aerospace engineering and the role of CFD. Nicole Sharp is our guest for today. She is the creator of a popular website about fluid dynamics and is really active as well in social media called FYFD. So, Nicole, I'd like to welcome you to our show and thank you for the interview today. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me, Tiffany.
Okay, so we'll jump right into it. Can you give our listeners just a little bit of background about, you know, who you are, why you got into the field and decided to create the website?
So like a lot of people who end up in aerospace, I got bit by this space bug as a kid. I think I was in about third grade when I saw an artist's conception of the International Space Station and turned to the kid next to me and said, I want to live there someday. And that was pretty much how the aerospace obsession started. So I chose to, as an undergrad, study aerospace engineering at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And it was there that I got introduced to fluid dynamics. And it was really in one of the introductory classes, I think, near the end of my sophomore year, where they started talking about how flow around airplane wings worked. That was the first time in any of my engineering classes that a professor said, okay, we're not going to talk anymore about the subject. And I just wanted to jump up and say, no, keep going. You finally got to something good. So that was kind of how my interest in fluid dynamics started out. And I spent the next couple of years doing some research with professors there, going and getting a master's degree, where I did a lot of experimental work looking at turbulence. And then eventually I made my way to Texas A&M, which is where I did my PhD, also doing experimental work. But during that time, I found that I was increasingly frustrated that people just didn't really know much about fluid dynamics. This was about 10 years ago. And I thought, hey, we have this field that's so visually beautiful, that's so applicable to people's daily lives and to almost everything we experience, and yet people don't get to see and hear about it because the only sites that you can find information on, you pretty much already need a master's degree to understand. So that was kind of the motivation behind creating FYFD originally, was just, I love fluid dynamics and I think more people should know about it. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time every day writing something cool about this field. And it was the kind of thing where I expected I would be shouting into the void and no one would ever look at it or read it. And yet somehow I built a rather substantial audience even as a graduate student. And that ultimately helped determine my career path.
I definitely can relate to, you know, deciding, hey, there's something really cool about this and I kind of want the world to know. And I think that's one of the cool things about social media. You've been able to kind of use that as a platform to kind of simplify it because, you know, the attention span is short. And so it's not like sitting in a class and learning. So being able to share that in bite-sized pieces throughout the platforms, I think that's really cool. What has been your favorite topic that you like to kind of regularly have segments about on your different social media platforms and videos?
So I feel like that's a bit of a tough question because over 10 years, I've written more than 2,500 articles, many of them on extremely different topics. So it's hard to, it's kind of like being asked to pick your favorite child, I guess, which is the best. There have been some really cool ones over the years. I think what I enjoy the most is when I discover something that just is totally unexpected and kind of blows my mind. So an example of that that comes to mind is the star-nosed mole. So I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of these things, but they're these tiny mammals that live in I think the New England area, and they have these crazy finger-like protrusions on the front of their face, hence the name star-nosed mole. It turns out that the star-nosed mole can sniff underwater. It actually blows out a bubble of air, is able to have that, you know, touch, say, a chemical trail leading to food, and then suck that bubble back in before buoyancy pulls it off of its face, and is able to actually track things underwater and find prey that way. And that's just kind of mind-bogglingly crazy to me. Like, who would have expected that there are tiny animals that can sniff underwater?
Right, right. That's a pretty unique discovery. So when you created the site or the platform, you were a PhD student in aerospace engineering, studying surface roughness induced transient growth in hypersonic boundary layers. That's a bit of a mouthful, you know, especially for me. I'm not an engineer. but, you know, I would like for us to kind of break that down. What is surface roughness, and why is it relevant to the study for hypersonic vehicles?
Yeah, it is. It's quite a mouthful, that dissertation title. Full disclosure, when I chose what the dissertation title was going to be, I tried to make it as concise as possible because I knew I was going to have to keep typing it over and over in lots of forms. So I just didn't want a super long title. All right, so let's break it down. So starting with surface roughness. So surface roughness is pretty straightforward. We have all experienced it. If you imagine like an airplane wing, you could have roughness that is from screws or fasteners sticking up on it, which is what we would call isolated roughness. You could also have a rough surface like what happens when you put sandpaper on it, in which case you have distributed roughness, where it's kind of rough all over the place instead of rough in one specific spot. And when you're talking about a flight vehicle, including something that's hypersonic, so something that's going to go faster than 5 times the speed of sound, then you can have all kinds of other places that roughness shows up. It could, again, show up where fasteners are linking together different parts of a vehicle. It could be because the underside of, say, a capsule like the Apollo capsule or the Orion capsule is during reentry, they ablate. They actually have bits of material coming off, and that leaves this very rough surface on the bottom. So that is another place where surface roughness is a major issue in hypersonic vehicles. Or you could have spots where somebody intentionally stuck surface roughness on there, just to see what would happen, which is actually something that we did on some of the later space shuttle missions.
Okay. That is a lot. And now that gives me a greater understanding of it. And hopefully to the listeners as well. What is the importance of phenomena were really brought to light when NASA launched the space shuttle Discovery. Can you tell us anything about that, or what are your insights there?
Yeah, this is kind of one of my favorite stories for illustrating why my PhD came about. So we lost in, I believe, 2003, the space shuttle Columbia. And the loss of that shuttle was due in part to damage that was caused by foam from the external fuel tank coming off and hitting part of the space shuttle and damaging it, so that when the craft tried to re-enter, that damage caused the whole spaceship to break up. And for a couple years after that, there was, of course, a huge investigation and trying to figure out where the problems were and prevent anything like that from happening again. So when the return to flight mission, STS-114, happened, this was in 2005, I think, that was probably the most scrutinized space shuttle launch that had ever happened. And when they launched the space shuttle, they sent it up. It was going to dock with the International Space Station. And basically before they docked, they had the spacecraft do like a belly flip in front of the space station so all the astronauts on board could take photos of the underside of the shuttle, which would then go down to engineers on the ground who could look for any damage or any potential problem spots. And what they found were a couple of spots where something was sticking out on the underside of the space shuttle. And so the space shuttle had most of its surface covered by these black tiles that were the heat shield. But in between those tiles were little pieces of ceramic-infused fabric that were called gap fillers. And mainly those gap fillers were there so that the tiles didn't rattle against each other during launch, because there's a lot of vibration whenever you're launching rockets. So what had happened was that some of these gap fillers had worked their way out from between the tiles and were sticking out roughly an inch above the surface. And this was a problem because NASA found that nobody, themselves included, could predict what was going to happen whenever you have this surface roughness sticking out in those kinds of places on the underside of the vehicle. Like when the vehicle comes in to land, is that stuff just going to burn off? Is it going to cause the flow to go from a nice, orderly laminar boundary layer to one that's crazy and turbulent? No one could say. And that was a big problem, obviously. So NASA, despite being very risk-averse, actually sent an astronaut to the underside of the space shuttle on a spacewalk, which was something they'd never done before. And they had this astronaut pull out those gap fillers by hand. He just like grabbed it with his gloves and pulled them out. And if you want to, you can actually see those gap fillers at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. That would be something interesting to check out. Clearly, aerospace is an important field of study. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into your research. You were an experimentalist. Can you discuss how experimentation supports computational research or vice versa? Or tell us, how it may differ from maybe just some other form of research.
So this is one of those areas that I think can get a little controversial depending on who you ask, because you have both experimentalists and computationalists who are very much convinced that their form of study is the superior one. But I kind of came up academically in a group that more or less equally valued the two and viewed the experimentalists and the computationalists as partners in trying to understand the phenomena that we're studying. So one of the things we really emphasized was that experimentalists needed to design their experiments in such a way that they could be easily simulated. Because one of the problems that can come up very easily is that I can throw something in the wind tunnel and run it and find out information quite easily. That doesn't mean that it's easy to set up for somebody doing the computations. And if you want to have those two sides be able to work together and inform one another, you need them to be starting out from the same page. You need to have both the experiment and the digital experiment be equivalent. And what's really valuable about that, what allows those things to inform one another, is that I, as an experimentalist, if I go and I turn on a wind tunnel, I know that what I'm getting is physically real. But a lot of the time, I can only measure a couple of things. And that could be because just whatever type of measurement I'm doing only allows me to measure in certain places or at certain times. I just literally can't have all of the information in the flow, but I know that the information I'm getting is physically real. Whereas somebody who's doing a computation, is able to get all of the information everywhere for every time, potentially, depending on what kind of computational technique they're using, which would obviously be really helpful if it directly corresponded to the exact same situation that I'm studying. So the goal was really figuring out how to bring those two sides together so that the experiments could inform the physical realism that was behind the simulation, so that we could get confidence in what that simulation is saying. And then the simulation can inform all of the physics that we can't possibly measure in our experiment.
That actually sounds like, you know, if those two pieces could work better together, that may be an even further step towards having real validation, because it's kind of the computational side as well as the experimental side. Can you tell us a little bit more about any of your research or what sort of experiments you've actually ran?
Yeah, so the work that I was doing, as we said, was looking at what surface roughness does at hypersonic speeds. And to do that work, I got to work in a very, at the time, unique in the world facility that was housed at Texas A&M. It's called the Mach 6 Quiet Tunnel, and it was originally developed by engineers at NASA Langley, who used it for a kind of a proof of concept that they could build a tunnel like this. And then it got mothballed for about a decade, and then eventually made its way to Texas A&M, where we put it back together and got it running again. And one of the things that made this facility really unusual is the fact that it's a quiet tunnel. So something that happens at high speeds, either supersonic or hypersonic facilities, is they have walls, right? And whenever your flow on the wall transitions from being nice and orderly and laminar to being turbulent, it actually generates noise. And that noise just bombards whatever model you put into the wind tunnel. And if you're flying around in the open atmosphere, there are no walls, which means that you don't have this noise that's radiating on your model. And so when what you're trying to study is how a disturbance gets into a flow and grows, you don't want to have all these extra disturbances hitting whatever you're trying to measure. So what was neat about this facility was that it had specific measures in place to try and reduce that problem and to prevent that transition on the walls of the tunnel as long as possible, so that you could have a model that was in flight-like conditions. And so that's what I worked with. And the other thing that kind of made it unique amongst facilities that existed at that time, because there was one other facility that had quiet flow at the time, was that this one could run for about 40 seconds, which doesn't sound very long until you consider that the other one ran for a few, I think, 100 milliseconds at any given condition. So the 40-second runtime was short, but it was really necessary for the kinds of experiments that I was doing. And all of my work started out by building a cone model that had different kinds of roughness that I could put on it. And then we would put it in the wind tunnel, and we would try to measure the disturbances that showed up behind the roughness that I had created and study how they grew as they went further down the cone. I could never get to a high enough Reynolds number to get it to be fully turbulent, although thankfully some of my computational companions were able to show that I was this close to making it to turbulence. But it was the first time that we were able to demonstrate in hypersonic conditions this particular form of disturbance growth that could cause turbulence.
That's an interesting experiment. I mean, I sometimes you think about it's one perception of it on when you learn about it computationally, but to actually see it and test those things, and you know, you guys are actually building something, I think that really makes it a little bit more interesting to me. And that's my opinion. What are some of, I guess, in those different experiments or any research that you've done, what are you most proud of, or maybe what is one of the most significant outcomes of some research that you've done?
Well, one of the things that made that PhD work really valuable was that it was literally the first time anyone had demonstrated that this particular mechanism occurred in hypersonic boundary layers. And that was a pretty tough thing to achieve because all of the experiments that have been done at low speed in low speed wind tunnels for this basically consist of you have a flat plate, you put roughness on it, and then you take your instrument and you map out in slices what the flow looks like at this position behind the roughness and this position and this position and this position and this position and so on. And you do this by running the wind tunnel for a very long time so that you can measure at these hundreds or thousands of points. And then you can take these snapshots at different locations and do your analysis and show that this mechanism, which was called transient growth, was occurring. The problem comes when you try to translate this to hypersonic speeds and you can only run the wind tunnel for 40 seconds at a time.
Yeah.
and to make matters worse, you can't run it for 40 seconds and then immediately run it again for 40 seconds because to run the wind tunnel required this big infrastructure where we had a room full of compressors that created a reservoir of high pressure air that we used to run the wind tunnel and the facilities that were necessary for the wind tunnel to run. So I was basically trying to take a measurement technique that relied on the fact that you could just run a wind tunnel at low speeds for hours at a time and adapt it for working in this like very fast snapshot kind of way, which meant that I ended up using hundreds of runs in order to try and piece together all of this data. And those runs had to be done very particularly every like 3.5 hours to make sure that whatever data I took in my 40 seconds would line up with the previous set of work. So it was a really intense experimental campaign, but it made me feel really good to get to the end and actually be able to show like, yes, transient growth is occurring. And this is literally the first time anyone's shown that that happened in hypersonic vehicles.
What was your timeline on that experiment? Like how long from kind of concept to results? How long did you work on that project?
Oh, that's an ugly question. That's asking how did your PhD run? And the answer is it didn't run like it was supposed to.
I don't think things like that always do. Yeah, definitely understand that.
No. I mean, there's all kinds of things that get in your way when you're running experimental campaigns. So we had some interesting setbacks, like when the student ahead of me accidentally sandblasted the inside of the tunnel, and we had to spend about a year getting it back up to the standard that it needed to be at to have that low disturbance quality. And that was because nobody foresaw the problem that was going to happen. It just, you know, sometimes there are accidents. We had another one, I think the day I finished my candidacy exam, the compressors that we'd been running with, one of them had an explosion in the stage 4 of the compressor, the really high pressure part, and that happened to be our more reliable compressor that went down. So that meant I spent the next 6 months or so working on just trying to change out the lab's infrastructure so that we could get the tunnel running again and I could actually do my experiments. So I had a rough journey to getting those done. And the last, you know, 6 to 9 months of my PhD involved taking a lot of data very quickly.
Yeah. Well, and, you should feel some relief and, just kind of be happy that you made it through that, you know, and you got to the end results and, you were able to get the data that you needed. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about, ask you about two questions regarding kind of your platform and the type of things and, that you get or content that people also submit to you. What would you say is probably the most unusual video or topic request that you've received on any of your platforms?
So one of the things that's funny about running a site like this, which is one of very few that are going to come up if somebody just starts Googling random fluid dynamics questions, is that I get a lot of very odd, random questions from people. Not necessarily submissions for a post, but just kind of like, hey, I'm trying to figure out why my coffee maker does this weird thing. Or why does my teapot dribble the way that it does? And I think one of my favorite examples of that kind of thing was actually a vendor from Wrigley Field who asked me how to pour beer faster so that he could serve more people more quickly than his competitors.
Okay, so that was like a business question. It was about beer, but it was a business question. So,
Yeah.
That's very unique. I would say that is unusual.
It was very memorable for me.
Yeah. Well, were you able to help him or point him in the right direction? Or
I mean, I was able to give him an answer on how to pour beer out of an aluminum can as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, I think the other circumstances surrounding what was necessary to do this made it hard to implement that method.
Yep, I can imagine. Those are all the questions that I have. I want to thank you for joining us for this episode. It has really been interesting, your insight on being an experimentalist and aerospace engineering and NASA. I hope that our audience finds the episode interesting as well. And thank you for your time.